Welcome to the Hollywood Outsider, an award-winning weekly entertainment podcast. And in this very episode, we are going to talk about defunct TV shows that deserve a movie reboot, our fascination with serial killers, and great movie plots that went wrong, as well as our spoiler-free review of The Tomorrow War. Let's get on with the show. My name is Aaron Peterson, and I am your host for this episode. Now, this is the holiday weekend or week, so we are actually off this week, but we are still putting together a nice little compilation episode of some of our most popular topics from earlier this year. We'll be back next week, where our episode will be about Black Widow and characters that came back from the dead. Really, that's it. Characters that came back from the dead. Is that a cool thing? Do we hate that? Do we love that? Maybe Han from Fast and Furious will come up, because what? If you've seen it by now, you understand what I'm talking about. And we'll talk about a lot of other stuff. But on this episode, we have actually three topics that were from the most popular episodes and the first little portion of this year. Now, joining me for most of these topics are John Davenport, Amanda Sink, and Troy Heinrichs will be joining me for the Tomorrow War review in just a little bit. But first, let's go into this defunct TV shows that we would like to see return as a movie reboot. Let's get into it. Defunct TV shows that deserve to be rebooted as a feature film. Now, we've seen this a bazillion times. Baywatch, Spencer Confidential is a recent one, countless others. So what do you think it is about dead TV shows? And we're talking about not on the air anymore, that make features so appealing for the reboot.
You know, it's one of those things that in my mind, where I think it's the perfect idea. It's like a Venn diagram of nostalgia, possibility, and then characters doing something completely different. So it's kind of sits in the middle and makes it something that would be usually a lot of fun to enjoy.
Yeah, a lot of times I feel like it's got to be something that I could see other people playing the role in. Because if it's something where this character is, they just have to be played by this actor or actress, then I don't feel like this is the best, that's the best content to take and do a reboot into a film. But a lot of times it's from something that you love, like John said, you have nostalgia for, and it's something that has an intriguing plot point, or it has a great story, one that could be easily manipulated but still stay true to its core. And that's where it gets fun, especially if it's like an action or a comedy. Those can easily be manipulated versus, you know, maybe a drama or something.
I'm a big fan of the nostalgia factor. I think that's obviously a big reason, because name recognition is the number one, you know, thing that studios go for, because they're not thinking of original fare too often. So, I mean, a lot of times they're going back to the well that they know will feel safe and warm with people. And I get that. But there's also that added bonus, I think, that isn't just nostalgia, where it's the premise has been tried. So they know it can work if they just get it right. Or the premise was so clever, it could be done a different way. Like, there's even some that have done it very poorly, like Fantasy Island, which I'll talk about a little bit more in a second or in a minute, is one where great idea, not a great execution, but a great idea. Take Fantasy Island, make it a horror movie. So it's not just ripping off the show, it's doing something different. And I think that that's really important to these. And I kind of feel like if they did more of that, people would be less inclined to just jump on the, oh, they're just remaking another thing. They're just doing another thing we've already seen 10 times before. You know, they're doing something new with it. And I think they should do more of that. And that would be beneficial to them trying to get franchises out of the deal. Kind of like 21 Jump Street did that. Made it a completely different kind of movie, and people loved it.
Sure did steal one of my mentions.
It's one of mine too.
Sorry. Oh. Okay. Well, let's jump into it. What are your favorite examples of this being done right? And why was that the right way to do it?
Well, so I'll leave 21 Jump Street for John, since he had it on his list. I think one that immediately popped into my head was Charlie's Angels. Now,
which one? There's like two interpretations of that.
Oh, that's true. The first one with Lucy Liu, Cameron Diaz. Yeah, they had a lot of fun chemistry. Now, I'll say though, that the latest reboot of it with Kristen Stewart, I was really surprised by. And that was good, too. I had a lot of fun with that one. So really, that's one that can be easily morphed and you just place new, engaging, and awesome action females in it, switch up a little bit of the plot, and it's the same thing that you can just continue to reboot. I'm fine with that. I love it. I think they're so fun, and you get a little bit of different personalities in the different iterations. So that was one of the first ones that came to my mind.
I was really kind of bummed Crispin Glover didn't show up in that the Kristen Stewart one. I was just like, just bring him back. The Thin Man, just bring him back. He was my favorite part of those movies. I just thought he's so ridiculously over the top. Him and, well, Sam Rockwell was pretty kick-ass, too.
Yeah, that's true.
That little dance he does where Drew Barrymore is tied up, I thought that was fantastic. John, what about you? Tell me about how 21 Jump Street got it right.
21 Jump Street got it right because it took a premise of his show that was sometimes way too serious, way too melodramatic, way too much like, here we are with teenagers and this is how it's supposed to be, and then turns it into a comedy. And in that center of that comedy are two guys who don't belong to be working together in any way, shape, or form at all. So, and it's just done in such a way that the laughs just keep hitting harder and harder and harder, and it is just so much fun and energetic, and the characters have really put a new spin on the idea of Channing Tatum for me, and Jonah Hill, who was somebody who I could take or leave, was somebody that I was like, I need to keep watching him. You know, it's just got everything for sure I ever wanted.
Yeah, I will say, I mean, now that you bring that up, what was interesting about how they did that was they kind of, Channing Tatum comes across as this dimbulb for a big portion of the movie, but he's not. Like, they actually fleshed out his character because he starts off as just like this idiot jock, and you're just like, wow, he is the dumbest man. How long are they going to run this joke for? And then he becomes like a real person by the end.
Yeah.
I dug that. I mean, Jonah Hill is pretty much just Jonah Hill, but Channing Tatum, I felt like they really gave him a stretch. My favorite example is The Untouchables. A lot of people don't even know now, but that was a TV show that they brought into the 80s, and man, I that's where we discovered Kevin Costner, really. That's what kind of exploded his career. That's the famous Robert De Niro gains a lot of weight so he can play Al Capone. Sean Connery plays the most
Chicago way
Scottish Irish cop ever. He's fantastic in the movie, wins the Oscar for supporting actor, takes his hairpiece off for a movie, shocks me. You know, everything about that film and how it went was just masterful. Brian De Palma really created something different with it. That score just like permeates throughout the entire film. There's really not anything wrong with that movie. And I've watched it from start to finish probably 50 times. And I still don't think there's really anything wrong with it. And the whole, what is it? Train station?
Yeah, a train station.
Yeah, that whole scene still is one of my favorite film sequences ever.
I really wrestled with the idea of picking that one myself. Another one that I couldn't get away from as far as being a really great adaptation is Mission Impossible.
Even though it's not anything like the show, though.
No, it doesn't have to be anything like the show. It's just something.
Can we at least say that, and granted, that probably is a benefit because it does it its own thing. Like, it makes it the Tom Cruise show as opposed to doing them. But very rarely in those movies is it actually a team aspect. It's just, hey, who's going to help me get in the building?
It's Tom Cruise.
it's the Ethan Hunt show is really what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And like, it, you know, it starts off, and actually now that you're mentioning it, the very first movie starts off of like, they're all working as a team and they're doing really great. And then somebody murders the team and it becomes nothing but Ethan Hunt all the time.
Yeah. And every time there are more members, they either don't come back for the next movie or they're dead.
Right. Yeah. Spoilers.
You know, one that I also thought of that to me is just a perfect example of this, and that's the Addams Family.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh God, yes.
I thought John might be on board. I was waiting for him to say it, but
I can't dip into my own well that much.
You do dip in your own well a lot. But
I do.
The characters,
nobody else is dipping in it.
The atmosphere, just everything about that movie is representative of the show in its core, but it also springs its own personality into it.
Raul Julia as Gomez is like one of the best depictions of Gomez ever on screen.
Honestly, all of the characters to me, in my personal opinion, they are the best in the film adaptation.
Really?
Yeah, you really can't go wrong with that.
They're just, I mean, when you think of the Addams Family, most people are going to go back to the film. They're not going to think of the show.
That's actually true. Yeah, you're probably right.
Yeah, the show took such a big swing with it. And, you know, there's something about like the show and the movie. And, you know, the idea behind the Addams Family was to create the American family that's the exact opposite of what the American family is. And what I love about that so much is that what they created was a guy who's so obsessed with his wife that he'll do anything for her, and a wife who doesn't resent him. And I think that's hysterical.
And they do a really brilliant job of, and it was very subtle in the show. It's a little more overt, I think, in the films, but they do a wonderful job of showing it's okay to be weird. You know, it's okay to be quote unquote weird.
For sure.
And different and unique. It was great in the show because the show was really at a time where they were kind of masking what they were trying to say. I mean, they were trying to paint a broader picture that a lot of people that you think are monsters are really just good people that you're not giving the time to. And the movie, I think, says it a little bit more overtly in that respect. But either way, the message was always great in the film and the TV show. Films and the TV show.
What about The Fugitive? What do you guys think about that one as an adaptation?
Oh.
I am one of the biggest fans of the TV show that I know. Well, I'm the only fan I know of the TV show because everybody else is dead. But
I was going to say, haven't seen it.
It's old. It was really great. It's basically for younger people. Did you watch The Incredible Hulk? It's like The Incredible Hulk. It's like that. He was always on the run, trying to get away, trying to stay out of sight. But then he would always come across somebody where he could help them. And he just didn't know how to not help people. So he'd been framed by the one-armed man. So he was constantly searching for this, but he was also helping people along the way. And they would come to help him as well. And, you know, it's like that. And he did this for many, many years. I love the show. The movie, I love the movie. It's not... It's not the same as the show. I feel like it was a little too easy for him to find the one-armed man. I did like the tie-in with the prosthetics and stuff, and that's kind of how he found him. I thought that was pretty clever. So overall, like as a movie, I think it works great, and it's a great one-off. I didn't like U.S. Marshals, but I did like the movie. Yeah, I did like it. What about you?
Yeah.
That felt like a really roundabout way to say, I like the movie, but I don't feel like it's a true representation of the show.
I mean, it was. I mean, the basic plot of it was the same. And I love Harrison Ford. He's one of my favorite all-time actors. I think for diehard fans of the show, I just wanted it to a little bit more. I thought he just wrapped it up a little too easy for my liking.
Tommy Lee Jones is one of my favorite things about that.
Fantastic.
And fantastic. Every time I think about like when somebody says something to me that that may be relevant, but is none of my business and is not material to the actual thing that I'm working on, you know, like I didn't kill my wife, and he turns around and he just says, I don't care.
It's one of the
I think best about that lines. Scene every time I had to say I don't care.
I freaking love that performance. I was really excited when they gave him that spinoff. He got it, that U.S. Marshall spinoff, and Robert Downey Jr.'s in it. Wesley Snipes is in it. I mean, it's like a lot of people I love. It just felt like it was just recycling the plot from The Fugitive. And it just didn't work the second time. But he's great. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones is one of those actors where I feel like he'd be somebody you want to punch in the face if you met him. But he's one of the best actors of all time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Man, I don't have that, I don't know, testosterone or whatever where I just want to punch a dude just because I see him.
Go listen to all the stories of Tommy Lee Jones, and he's always that guy that just is curmudgeon-y. Like, he's really that guy.
Okay.
I'm sure he's lovely in his own way, but he doesn't sound like a delight. That's what I'm saying. Naked Gun is a great one. You know, you mentioned Police Squad a couple episodes ago, John. That was a TV show that went nowhere. It's a failure of a TV show, and they decided, we'll make the Naked Gun movie based on the Police Squad. Huge hit. Huge hit. And then, like, spawned two sequels. Fantastic. Fantastic movies. And the only downside is it's hard to watch it now, knowing one guy in the movies is probably a killer. It's really funny because you're watching it and you're like, OJ Simpson's really funny. Oh, but did he kill his wife?
Oh, damn it. He killed people.
I mean, it didn't fit. So damn. You got to quit, dude. Is that okay? I don't know. But I still watch
him. But we all know the truth.
Hey, court says he was innocent. He's still out there looking. He's trying to find him. Keep going. Keep searching
not
the golf course.
Not in the people's court. What is it? That's only the criminal case, not the other case.
Yeah, he lost the civil case.
The civil case. That's the one I was looking
for. But you only need 51%. You got six people that believe that he did it. And, you know, it is what it is. Regardless, I'm not here to determine a person's guilt or innocence. I'm just saying it's harder to watch those movies after that.
I feel like we'd be remiss to not mention Serenity.
That's a pretty cool story in itself, for sure.
I mean, it was done right. And it's one of the few that retains the originals.
I saw it in the theater. Not many did.
Old. Is that what you're trying to say?
No, because nobody else went. That's what I'm saying. Like, not many people saw it in the theater.
Well, like, the movie Serenity is actually what kicks so much life back into the show for Firefly. Sure, yeah. And if it wasn't for Serenity, the movie, I would have never discovered it. Because the way I discovered Serenity was that a friend of mine had gone and saw the movie in the theater because he had nothing else to go watch. And so as soon as he realized it was a TV show, he went and bought the series and then invited me over and we sat down and watched it, which his only complaint was, you know, it's really hard watching this knowing that they're fine all the way up until... Like, I'm not worried about anything that happens to them because I already know what's going to happen to them at the end of all this.
That's true.
It's a different
one. Also, I love that you're like, yeah, we sat down and we binged it. And it's like, okay, so you spent 6 hours of your day watching a TV
13.
Show?
13.
Yeah. I think it's 14. I think there's 14 episodes plus the movie.
I'm just joking.
I understand. But she's saying it isn't like the old days of binging, all right? It's not like 22 episodes of network show. You're not binging 24 here, all right?
Well, it's like binging today. It's like binging anything today is, you know, 13, 14
episodes. That's true.
If you get that much, now it's like eight.
Eight is like the max now.
I'm waiting for him to cut it down to four, and I'll just be in heaven. I'm like, sweet.
No, that's not even a TV show then anymore. That's just a very long movie.
That's what I want, Amanda.
Got to cut out some of the fat of the story right here. Well, they don't need to know why these two are hooking up.
Sometimes they just start humping. That's what I want. I just want them to start humping. Right. I don't need all the...
Right.
Hey, what are you doing tonight? Ah, we know. You're humping.
Speaking of humping, I cannot wait till our Patreon episode to talk about Basic Instinct. Just as a side note, I've been thinking about it since the watch.
Well, we'll get there.
Anyway, yeah.
Completely unrelated, but I like how you plug.
Well, you were talking about humping, and it just...
Fair. It's fair.
I cannot stop thinking about the soft porn that is Basic Instinct.
I do want to mention before we get to the bad ones, Borat. Fantastic. Many people don't realize that was spun off a TV show.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was spun off his HBO TV show.
That sounds
TV
like
show.
A bad show. Okay.
It wasn't great. The A-Team. I freaking love The A-Team. Wish it would have been a series. I still see Bradley Cooper.
Love it when a plan got together.
Yeah, that one. And Starsky and Hutch. Big fan of Starsky and Hutch. Do it. Do it.
That's a really good one I didn't even think about.
I really dig that movie. And they did something different with it. Like, they went complete comedy. It's kind of like 21 Jump Street, but ridiculous. And I think it worked. Do it.
Do it.
All right. How about ones that have been done very poorly?
The first one that comes to my top of my list is Lost in Space.
You didn't like the movie?
The movie just had so much going for it, but ultimately it's just a snooze fest as far as a movie's concerned. Like, I can't, like, every time I've seen it, I've fallen asleep.
I don't like the time travel part. That annoyed me.
Yeah.
But Matt LeBlanc, I thought, was great in that movie.
Oh, yeah. That was definitely one of those things where I wanted to see more Matt LeBlanc doing stuff like that. But yeah, it was at the same time, again, I think every single time I've seen that movie, I fall asleep, which is different from the TV show, the new TV show especially. I can't fall asleep in that new TV show.
Well, we're on opposite sides of that fence. I can tell you that.
Is there something wrong with you?
There's a lot wrong with me. What about you, man? Anything where you think it's done poorly, very poorly?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's also one that I would like to see redone because I know there's great potential, but they really screwed it up. And that is Bewitched.
Oh, the Nicole Kidman version?
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
And wasn't Will Ferrell in that?
Take, yes, yep. Take this away, this garbage, trash, dumpster fire. No, that is not Bewitched.
Well, I mentioned Fantasy Island, so I won't go into it too much. But let me say, I was in love with the idea. Make it a horror movie. Wow, that could be kick-ass.
And it sounded super cool.
Then it was actually kind of cool in the movie for a little while. And then you kind of get to the halfway point, and you're like, wow, this is not going to be nearly as stupid as I think it's going to be, right? And it does, and it doubles up on it. And it's just like, wow, you just keep getting dumber. I'm waiting for Jim Carrey to pop up at some point, because I'm just like, this is so dumb.
So you basically got catfished?
Yeah, yeah.
The movie.
Oh, my God. It was awful. It was awful. It's just not a good movie. And I know some people are like, no, it wasn't that bad. Yes, it was. I promise you. It really was. Yeah. But the other one I want to mention is Miami Vice. I freaking love Miami Vice, the show. It's such an 80s staple. Don Johnson, coolest guy on the planet. I'm sorry. Phil Michael Thomas, pretty close too. He's a pretty cool cat. Then they make this movie with two really cool guys. Colin Farrell is a cool dude. Jamie Foxx is one of the coolest guys ever. The same director, the creator of the show, came back. He's a pretty celebrated director, Michael Mann. And he makes the most boring cop movie I've seen in forever. And lets Colin Farrell keep the stupidest mustache that's ever been put on film. Ever. I think ever. And tries to say, this is really cool. Chicks are going to love this. Guys are going to love it. He's going to look so hot and sexy. And you're like, he looks ridiculous. He looks like Marlboro wouldn't even come let him come in for an audition. It's hideous. That's my Miami Vice theory.
That's a strong theory. You know, I have to bring this up because why not throw this in two different sections of the same episode? But one of the ones that I don't think they executed very well is Charlie's Angels.
The new one or the old one?
The old one, the you know,
Cameron Diaz,
Lucy Liu, that one, Drew Barrymore, why? That one. Yeah.
You, what do you smoke? Why do you and hate who is your dealer?
Women having fun. Why do you hate that?
You know, it's not that I hate women that? Having fun because I like the most recent you. One. The most recent one did it well.
You are drunk.
Wow. I mean, you like I the like most one. Recent one, but you don't like the. I just. Wow.
I don't like the Cameron Diaz one. I don't like the Lucy Liu. It's too much like, yeah, because we're girls and we're going to kick your ass because we're girls.
You mean
and
like I the just, show was?
Yeah. Did you watch?
No, the show wasn't like that at all, honestly.
It was just a little more serious, but it was kind of like that.
It was a lot more serious. They weren't like, we're girls and we're gonna kick your ass.
I don't
like,
remember
come on,
that
have some self-respect.
But it was, wow, are you serious? You trying to come yes. at women, you anti-feminist?
I'm not coming at women. I'm
you
coming
are
at
coming
women
at
being
women.
Do I have any no, popcorn? I'm coming at women being depicted like shitheads. Like those women
who
were
dumb. Who are you
to
determine what a woman should be like
yeah.
and shouldn't
yeah,
be
John,
like?
Who are you to determine?
Those women are the worst example of like, we're so women. Ugh.
Let women be whoever the hell they want to be, John.
Those are the stupid-ass woo girls out there at the bar you don't want to be have anything to
they
do with.
They were not at all. I thought they were actually pretty strong
you're
independent
so
women.
You're so wrong.
The theme yeah, song was Independent Women or something. It was, you know, Destiny's
it was the
Child.
Beyonce song.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was Destiny's Child.
There's nothing
independent
about those women.
I think you got that one wrong. I think it's two against one. We're going to disagree on this one. But you have the right.
We're going to have to put this to in the group, the Facebook group.
Sure. Anybody listening?
You know what? I'll tell everyone they're wrong. That one is, those are terrible movies.
The second one is a terrible movie.
Those are terrible movies. I'll give you that one.
No, he wants both of them, though. He wants to
I want both of them. Yeah. You know what?
Well, you can't have that.
Crimes of the second involve the first. It's all going down.
You don't get that. No, sir.
Uh-huh. I totally do.
You see this finger? No, sir. Oh,
wow.
No.
Don't care about the finger.
That just got real. All right. So, Amanda. Let's start with you. Give us your three examples of a defunct TV series you'd like to see rebooted. You can do all three of them, and you can tell us how you would do it if you want.
Okay, so I mentioned Bewitched, and this one I would really like to see as like a darker version of it. Now, to be fair, I know we've gotten a glimpse of it through WandaVision, and that's not why I selected this show, just for clarification. But I would like to see it more in the scope of just like a dark horror type of show, but still with the comedic element, because I think then it could really be something cool.
Like she's a witch, but she's mean. She's an evil
witch.
I don't
want her to be an evil witch, but maybe there's like darker themes at play that she has to address. And that would be cool. While also trying to maintain her day-to-day life. I always like that multitasking woman thing.
Okay. I like that. I would watch that.
Alias is another one. Great show.
Now you're speaking my language.
Honestly, just take the show and make it into a movie. I don't need you to make too many adjustments. Honestly, keep the lady. Just do it. I just want more Alias.
You want Jennifer Garner to still play her? Sydney Bristow?
I would like that. I think she still has the full reign and capacity. What was that movie she just did a few years ago where she was some badass?
Peppermint. Can't even remember. She just did Peppermint, which wasn't too long ago.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of.
It was just last year or the year before.
She is just at her core. It's so funny.
It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
When I think of Jennifer Garner, sometimes I think of 13 going on 30, and I'm like, wow, she's so like girly and cute and, you know, all the type of woman that John hates, apparently. And then she shows me true range when she is an independent badass that apparently is the only good type of woman for John.
Wow.
And
yes,
shade. I don't know if you ducked or what, but shade is coming at you left and right.
I don't need the duck. This ain't shit.
So I think that would be a lot of fun, and it would garner a lot of interest.
God, you groan. I was with you, and then you dad joked your ass out of it.
Okay. Then my last one, because I'm trying to go not with my normals, like mm-hmm. Buffy and Angel. So
she made sure to throw them in there. I would like to see those movies too.
Yeah.
If I could do it, I totally would. Okay.
I'm trying to branch outside of who I am, okay?
I'm a girl. And I can do it.
John, I can't stand you. So my last one is Moonlighting. And this is such a great... Now, here's the question, though, Aaron. I know you love the show.
I do. I'm just glad you said it because I can't say it.
Why can't you say it?
Because
he's so proud.
It would be like I would have Moonlighting and like I would just be doing what you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But would you want to have Bruce Willis? Like now Bruce Willis?
No, absolutely not.
No. Okay.
But I would,
just want to clarify.
I actually thought about Moonlighting. My concern was I don't know if you could ever recreate that chemistry.
It was predicated off the fact that those two people hated each other.
Yeah, that's what made it work so well, because both of them did not like each other. But what,
I feel like
idea?
It's there. I feel like there's two people there, and I didn't have my finger on who it would be, who I would cast. Hmm. I just knew Bruce Willis is past his time. But
yes.
This show, I mean, if you find the right two people with the perfect chemistry where there's a little bit of love and hate between them, and you can just feel, I think that's what it was between them, is that they had negative tension between them, but because they're acting, it came across as very intense chemistry. And so if we can just recreate and find a pair like that and just turn it into like a detective series sort of thing.
Like a trilogy.
So fun. Yeah, it would be so fun. I would love it.
I'd be all over that. Absolutely. Great call. Good. I like it.
Thank you.
John, what do you got? I assume they're all guy shows.
Oh, of course. They're definitely guys, not women empowerment. And we're going to kick ass because we're dudes. Because that's how dudes work.
Mine are all guy shows. So it's okay.
Yeah. So my very first one is a show called Misfits of Science. Aaron, I know you remember this show.
I love Misfits of Science. Yeah.
Yeah. So if you don't remember what Misfits of Science are, Amanda, because you were a fetus. You weren't even a fetus then.
It's basically a fetus,
I said. So it's basically like a superhero show from the 80s. And what you got is a scientist who's trying to take that already?
Okay. Go ahead. I'm listening. I don't want to be a woman where I listen and don't interrupt a man's voice.
You two. Get in separate rings or corners.
If you didn't watch the show is about a bunch of superheroes that they're not really the greatest of superheroes. Like one's a rock star who got electrocuted and now he can shoot out laser bolts from his hands. One's a girl with telekinetic ability. One's like this ginormous guy who is in the show. He was acted by the guy who did Harry and the Hendersons. He was Harry, where he can go from super tall to really, really little tiny. tiny. And the whole reason why he got himself set up like this is because he just wanted to be normal height, and he just went a little too far. And they are sent out to go solve crimes. Well, what I would want to do is something where the superheroes of the world that we do know, like, you know, the big deal ones, something happens to them, and this is all what we're left with. And so kind of like a Mystery Men meets 21 Jump Street, but on the scale of Men in Black.
I like this. Yeah. Okay. I would be in on that. Absolutely.
My next show is a show called Voyagers. Aaron, do you remember Voyagers?
I do not. I remember the name. I don't know. I didn't watch it. I remember the name.
This basically is you got a time traveler who is, traveling throughout history, trying to right a whole bunch of wrongs. So kind of like Quantum Leap, but this is pre-Quantum Leap. And he loses his almanac that would be his history thing to know what, know where to go in time. Okay. And what's going on in time so that he'd know how to fix it. So he essentially kidnaps like a middle school kid who's a genius at history and takes him throughout history to right all these wrongs and to fix what's wrong with everything. So
it sounds awesome, except for there's a little creepy under vibe there where I'm like, he's kidnapping a high school kid. I mean, that just feels like a different kind of movie than I thought. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, it really is. But what I think would be kind of cool is to hand this over to Will Ferrell and let him do his Will Ferrell thing on this.
I mean, I'm kind of over Will Ferrell, but I would give him the opportunity to win me back. How's that?
Well, I would like to see Will Ferrell from and the name of the movie just escaped me.
Get Hard.
No, not that one. It's the one where he's living the life and he's got the novelist kind of narrating his whole life.
Oh, Stranger Than Fiction?
Stranger Than Fiction, that's the one. Okay, so Stranger Than Fiction. So where he's actually being more serious, well, I would like to see him do kind of handle this more of a serious realm, but at the same time, know when to drop the bits of comedy in there.
Okay, now I'm on board.
Yeah. And then finally, there's another show that it probably only lasted for half a season or a season. It's a show called Freaky Links. It was in the late 90s, early aughts. It's a takeoff of the Blair Witch Project, where a guy, his brother had died, and he's going through the internet, and he ends up finding a link that showed him that his brother's alive somewhere. But he was going through all these dark web contacts and found this video. And it turns into this investigation show where he's going off and trying to find his brother, but also there's a bunch of like weird ghosts and stuff that these links end up taking him to. And I really couldn't think of a way to bring this to the big screen. But again, I like the show so much and I like the idea behind it that I'm sure that doing something, I don't want to say Blair Witch like, but something like Saw like with this would be really interesting.
Okay, that would be cool. That's something I don't know. So I would be really curious to see what they did with that.
Yeah.
And it sounds like with not a lot of content, you still have a lot of flexibility to do what you want with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well,
hey, can I mansplain some more for you, Amanda? Oh,
God. All right. My first one is Millennium, which was a show on Fox. It was kind of like a spinoff from X-Files, starred Lance Henriksen. I was a big fan of the show. Now, granted, you would kind of have to change the date, but I'll get there. So a former FBI profiler with the ability to look inside the mind of a killer, he begins working for a mysterious Millennium Group, which investigates serial killers, conspiracies, the occult, and people obsessed with the end of the millennium. So I would obviously have to bounce ahead to like 2097 or something, but this could be like a fantastic starring vehicle for somebody like Liam Neeson, I think, to get him out of those bad action movies he's been doing for the last couple of years and get him back into something a little bit more tangible. You could add some high-tech tweaks because the character's name is Frank Black, and he's very good. He excels at hunting serial killers. So I think it would be interesting to have a character that they use because he's so much better than the most advanced of technology. He's just that good. And that, I think, could be a nice spin on it as well.
God, that'd be a lot of fun because I did love that show.
I love that show. I loved it. And my next one is Simon and Simon. I love Simon and Simon. I'm a huge fan of that show. And if you've never heard of it, it's from the 80s. It's two brothers. They're completely different taste. AJ is very prim. He's proper. He's fancy. And he wants to be rich, basically. While his brother Rick is tactless, rougher on the edges, lives like a cowboy. But they're always wonderful brothers. They always come together. They're close. They care about each other. and they work together as private detectives in this agency. So even though they're polar opposites, they always come together, and they do, you know, sometimes begrudgingly, but they care about each other. I would love to see, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but I would love to see an oil and water combo like Zac Efron and The Rock, because I'm a big fan of what they did in Baywatch.
Oh yeah. I was just going to say they were great though.
They were so fun. I mean, they could, you know, one's an older brother, one's a younger brother. I just love them together. I love their chemistry. Or, you know, maybe you reunite Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles from Supernatural.
Well, that would be great too. Yeah.
Ooh.
Did you ever see that they redid the opening with John Hamm and Adam Scott?
For Supernatural?
No, for Simon and Simon.
No. did they really?
They did a shot for shot remake of that opening for the show with John Hamm and Adam Scott. And John Hamm was the older brother, and Adam Scott was the one who always wanted to be rich.
I can see this.
It was fantastic.
Oh my gosh.
I would watch that movie. I would watch it. My last one, this is a show I've mentioned before, but it's probably been a while since I mentioned it. One of my all-time favorite shows, and it only lasted like 16 episodes. But Vengeance Unlimited, I freaking love that show. I would love to see a movie of this. Mr. Chapel had a hidden backstory. So you'd probably need a trilogy, I think, to get all the details. I'm big on trilogies, as you can tell. And what he did in the show and what he would do in the movies is he makes criminals pay their dues when the system fails to handle it. So they don't handle their end. The criminals walk. And because of that, people are being hurt in the process. Somebody gets away with murder. Somebody steals their entire fortune and gets away with it, you know, or steals their home and gets away with it. Things like that. He makes those things right. He rectifies that situation. And the best thing is he's not above breaking the law to do it. He will frame people for another murder if they got away with one murder. I mean, that's the kind of character Mr. Chapel was. He wouldn't hurt anyone, obviously. I'm saying like he would stick a body in their bathtub, something like that. That happened in an episode. And what he does is he offers to help people, and he gives them an option. You either pay me $1 million or you owe me a favor to be returned whenever I need it, which is usually to help somebody else. And it seems like, well, that's not fair. Well, I mean,
I like that.
He kind of uses it. So like, if you got the money, I'll go away. You'll never hear from me again after I solve your problem. But if you don't have the money, just help me help someone else. That's what he ends up doing.
Like a pay it forward idea. I already have two actors in mind for this. I love this.
Oh, it's such a great concept. And Michael Madsen was Mr. Chapel, and he was perfect for it. It just was so far ahead of its time because it was a dark as hell show. And Mr. Chapel, because, you know, he wasn't against breaking the law, but he was also this really quirky, weird. He played dirty. He wasn't afraid to stoop to whatever the level was. Like, it wasn't that he had no honor code. He's like, no, I'll get to your level. That's fine. I'll do the same things you're doing. I'll just do it better. And that's what he did every episode. And he was a little bit crazy, but deeply methodical. And I love that. And my person would be Dan Stevens, because I think he could play that crazy,
ooh,
maniacal genius. But Manda, who did you have?
Well, there's two people that came to mind because I know what your taste is.
Mm-hmm.
And two people came to mind that could fit in this based on things that you've liked from them before. And I don't know if they'd hit 100%, but the first one would be Chris Pine.
He could do it. I could see him doing it. He'd have to edge up a little bit, but I've seen him do parts like that. Sure. Absolutely.
The second one would be Timothy Oliphant.
I love
him. Because I feel like he starts to get edgy in Justified. I don't know if that's how dark this character, if he's a darker character, it sounds like he might be, if he'd fit.
He could. You know what? He does have a really wacky sense of humor. So, I mean, I think he could play it. I just think Dan Stevens is the guy that I would put in that pocket just because he's so, he can go from dark, gritty, to crazy, to funny, and he can do it on a dime. And that's what you need to do. Because I'm telling you, Michael Madsen, he never gets any appreciation for acting. You know, he's like, well, he's the same guy in everything. And he was kind of the same guy in this, but he does it so well. He's just so, I was scared of him at the same time I was, you know, praising what he was doing. I love that show.
I got to say, out of all of the options that were presented, that one is the one that's most compelling. Like, I want that today.
I think people would watch it today. It just, when it came out, it was a network show. Networks did not get that gritty, so it didn't last very long.
You should write up a pilot.
Treatment. Just write
send
up a treatment.
It to him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I should. Anyways, listening, I want
do
that.
Do a spec script. Do that. It.
Okay, we did want to mention a couple movies that we did see, even though we're technically on our own break for the holiday. There's a couple movies we want to mention. One, I'm just going to mention, which is The Forever Purge. My theory is if you know what the Purge films are, you know if you want to see it or not. I'm just letting you know it's better than that awful, awful trailer was. It basically follows purgers as they decide that the Purge no longer needs to have a time limit. So let's just purge all the time. And the world goes nuts. And purging starts happening, and there's a lot of reflections on recent events, I would say, in terms of political climates and the haves and have-nots and people of color. It felt like a documentary at points. I was like, wow, this is way close to what actually, because you know they filmed it before last year, but it felt like a lot of last year. So there's a little bit of intensity to watching it. I'm not going to do a full review on it. I just want to mention it. If you're wondering if it lives up to the other Purge movies, nothing lives up to Frank Grillo, just letting you know. But still, a intense, thrilling, taut film that I think lives up to the Purge name. So if you really want to see what the Purge is doing and where they're going, I think you definitely want to check it out. But still miss Frank Grillo. Still.
It's not dead yet?
Stop it, Troy. Stop it. I mean, what is this, like 6 movies it's had? I've enjoyed most of them. 5 movies? 6? I don't even know what the number is anymore, but lots of movies. I think there's 5 movies total. This, if they do another one, it'll be a 6th one. The rumors are that Frank Grillo might come back, according to the creator. If that were to happen, I think the world would be a better place. I think we could all, you know, get back to enjoying The Purge instead of thinking it's a living, breathing documentary.
So now it's The Purge Saga.
It is The Purge Saga. It's all about family. I don't know if you heard. But speaking of family, boom, perfect segue to the movie we actually want to talk about, which is The Tomorrow War. I keep thinking it's The Tomorrow Man. That is a different movie. This is The Tomorrow War. It's on Amazon Prime. It was a $200 million opus that was supposed to be in theaters, but instead we get in the luxury of our own homes. Here's what the plot is. Troy, are you ready to talk about this? Got time travel. You love time travel.
I love time travel.
Okay. The world is stunned when a group of time travelers arrive from the year 2051 to deliver an urgent message. 30 years in the future, mankind is losing a global war against a deadly alien species. The only hope for survival is for soldiers and civilians from the present to be transported to the future and join the fight. And among those recruited is high school teacher and family man Dan Forrester, who's played by Chris Pratt. Determined to save the world for his young daughter, Dan teams up with a brilliant scientist, Yvonne Strahovski, and his estranged father, J.K. Simmons, in a desperate attempt to rewrite the fate of the planet. Now, first, this is very important before we talk about the plot. I just want to ask you, did you know that the J.K. in J.K. Simmons stands for jacked? Because that mofo is jacked. He is like, boom! I was waiting for him to go, come over here, brother. Let's hug. I was just waiting for that. Sorry. It doesn't really pertain to the movie, but that's the first thing I thought of.
I thought it was going to pertain to, just kidding, I'm not really there, I'm over here.
Aw. No, it was kind of interesting to see J.K. Simmons just fully jacked. I've seen pictures of him in the gym on the old social media, but man, it's something to see it in person.
Now imagine you take that jacked physique and then go ahead and then put him back into one of those, what do you want to call it, like cops and robbers or maybe even a Sopranos type of role. He could really kick some ass.
I think so, yeah. Reminds me of Stephen Lang. You know, Stephen Lang did Don't Breathe, and he's done a lot of other stuff. But he's also an older actor who just started getting ripped, and now looks like he could beat the smack out of everybody. Way better than Steven Seagal. So apparently, action heroes don't always work out as much as other actors do.
Anybody can be an action hero, though, when you're fighting a CGI monster.
This is true. All right, so The Tomorrow War. This is one where I always get a little, when it's time travel, I get a little leery simply for the fact that time travel movies typically create rules and then forget to adhere to them for most of the film. Do you think that Tomorrow War created and stuck to their time travel rules?
I think it did a good job of explaining what the rules are for this time travel scenario. The crux of it basically is that they built a machine in the future that allows them to go back to the past, but it's not, I don't really want to call this one time travel. I want to call this one more space-time bending, because what they do is they actually create a wormhole that can go from one point in the future to one point in the past, but the flow of time is like a river always going downstream. So as the future progresses, the past also progresses. So if you jump in now, you're actually jumping further into the future. And then if you jump back, you're actually jumping back into the past, but further than where it was when you left it before. So it's like, it's always constantly moving. So it's really more of a wormhole between two points on the timeline than it is actual time travel, in my opinion. And I just confused the hell out of everybody.
No, I mean, I kind of get what you're saying. And they do present the, which is interesting, they do present the difference in time travel, as many people do, which is that time is a constant, which means if you exist in this moment and you travel to that moment, those moments are running concurrently, right? So you can't, like, there's a whole theory about that, that you can't just bounce to any moment in time. You have to, like, flow with time, basically, from where you are. It's a weird dynamic because you're talking about time travel. I want to go wherever Doc tells me I can go. That's ultimately how it should work. I want to schedule my time, but that's not the rules in this one. So it's running with that constant flow. Time is a constant theory. And I think for the most part it works. And they do a thing where the reason why they're using people that are older, say 40 plus, is because they won't be alive in the future. And therefore, there's no paradox when they get there, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And that makes sense. That works. Checks. I mean, you know, I know some people are debating some of the how it all works and whatnot, and some specifics. And I'm just like, it's a movie about time travel, which isn't real, man. So I don't know what to tell you. I mean, you got to let some things slide.
And I don't even think it's really about time travel. Like I said, I think it's about they make one jump to the future and they make one jump back to the past. And that's it. That's the entire time travel. It's not like you're bouncing back and forth constantly. Like, ooh, I went ahead one time, messed something up, came back, went back to try to fix it, came back, went back and tried to fix it again. So really, it's just they jump once, do what they need to do, and then jump home.
Yeah, there's no butterfly effect.
Yeah, there's no butterfly effect in this.
Did you like that it was more about father in the future trying to save his daughter, and this whole concept of people in the future needing people from the past to win the war in the future? Did you like the whole concept of Tomorrow War, or did you think it was too convoluted or simple enough to get by? Like, what did you think about the plot?
Yeah, I mean, in order to set up the gimmick of the time travel, I think it works. The fact that they're people from the future coming back to get people in the past that are already labeled to die of some known origin before this war even breaks out 20 years down the road. So, like, the gimmick of it all makes sense.
Well, yeah, I think the war breaks out soon after, and then it escalates fast, and then he jumps forward like 28 years later, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So I think that gimmick of, you know, trying to take people who are already labeled for death, basically, from what we know of the future records, and setting them into the future to actually make a contribution to society. I think they set up that story part really well in the opening sequence of our character, Chris Pratt, who is really trying to understand, like, what is his purpose in life? Is he meant to be this, you know, teacher his entire life, or is he meant to do something greater? Like, can I develop a new vaccine? Can I develop a new virus? Can I do, you know, any number of things that are different than teaching kids who don't care? Because these kids obviously are like, what's the point of learning if we're all going to die anyway? And so I think that's the setup of that concept, I think, works really, really well. Now, why the people of the future need to come back to the past to tell people to go back to the future, that part was kind of weird to me. Because if you're going to come back to the past, well, then just take all your technology from the future, bring it back here, set up shop, figure the crap out, and then when the people show up, go ahead and nuke them the first day they show up.
there definitely tends to be a whole lot of, we just got to swallow that going on, yeah, with this one. I mean, the whole theory is that the monsters are essentially like cockroaches, right? And once they arrive or they show their presence, there's no stopping them.
Yeah, they feast on the humanity as food.
Yep, exactly. And they're just eating, eating. That's all they do. There's no plan. There's no rhyme or reason. They are feasters. And they become, you know, they feast on the planet to where I think they got it down to what? Less than 500,000 people at one point?
Yeah, the entire world. Yeah.
Yeah. So what did you think of the creature design? Because I do think, even though some of the effects were a little janky in spots, where I'm like, well, that maybe that would look better on a big screen, but on a TV, even a big TV, it still looks a little... I like the design a lot. What did you think of the creature design?
Yeah, the creature design initially when we saw them, I was a little bit taken aback by it because I think it was like some of that, like you said, jankiness of how they're like bouncing into cars and bouncing off buildings and running down the street. It just looked very aggressive. And then, of course, when you get like the wide, expansive shots and you see like a horde of them coming at you and they literally run way faster than a human is supposed to be able to run.
World War Z all
yeah.
the way. Yeah.
But the humans still somehow seem to outrun them in every possible turn. I think that was a little bit strange. But I do like the design of these creatures because they were, I want to say they were kind of like insect meets grasshopper meets, I don't know. Like they have this really cool tail design where they basically like allows them to have a scorpion tail that, but it also shoots projectiles. So they get like an offensive weapon. It looks a little bit like a viperfish in the face. So I think there's a lot of really good stuff that they do here to make these aliens look scary enough. And definitely there's parts where there's a lot of tension built up where, ooh, it could be around the corner or don't open that door. And you do jump a couple times during the course of the movie because they are pretty freaky looking. I'm not going to lie. How the humans are able to dodge the spikes when they come, that part still kind of I laugh at because those spikes come pretty fast and furious. There's no way you're going to do that very quickly.
Yeah, they're coming in hot. They're coming in hot, man. So the cast is Betty Gilpin's in it. She's great. She was in Glow. You got J.K. Simmons, which we talked about as Dan's estranged father. Sam Richardson, who was in Werewolves Within and also in Veep. He's kind of a comedic effect. But Chris Pratt is the star. Yvonne Strahovski is the action star in the future. What'd you think of the two lead characters? And keep in mind, we want to be spoiler-free here, so just be mindful of that.
Yeah, I think Chris Pratt, this is another way to show his range and what he's able to do. I would say he's a little bit of a combo between Star-Lord mixed with his Jurassic World character in this one.
It really is, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Got a little bit of heart, a little bit of love and care and things of that nature that you would see from like the Jurassic World character. But at the same time, he has that like, oh my God, I'm going to kill something from a Star-Lord perspective. So just the ending sequence is something to behold, to say the least. I mean, it's completely damn ridiculous, but also so amazing altogether.
Why didn't you say that sooner? I won't say what that reference is, but once you hear it, you'll know why it's great.
I swear, Yvonne is the most amazing, versatile actress on TV today.
Wow, it's a bold statement, Cotton.
Because she can go from The Handmaid's Tale and be all weepy, cry, yelly, all that fun stuff, and then come right back into this kind of kick-ass action hero that we've seen her from, like, Chuck and 24, Live Another Day. There's just a lot of good with Yvonne's character in this, and I think she shows a lot of range, too, especially in one particular scene where they're walking down a beach, and I just was like, oh, man, I feel that. And I love watching her just do her thing. And I think the two of them together actually had some really great chemistry.
Okay, so what do you want to leave? I mean, I know you were really excited to talk about this one. This really felt like a summer blockbuster of sorts that, you know, the Fast movie is great, yes, but this would be something I would love to see in a theater. I think it would have played great in a theater. How did it play for you? I mean, what do you want to say in closing on Tomorrow War?
Yeah, I would say this is the, if we always thought Independence Day was about aliens because of Will Smith way back in the day, I think that this would have been a fantastic Independence Day weekend. It probably would have made a killing at the box office. It really was the popcorn, cast your mind to the wind and just go on a ride that you can probably see a lot of it coming. But at the same time, when things happen, it's happening and it's like, oh yeah, oh yeah. Like they're like the beats hit like you would expect them to hit. But yet you're still surprised at the same time. So I thought it was a fun action romp. I would have loved to have seen this in IMAX or Dolby Cinema because I think the sound was fantastic. I mean, my whole house was rumbling for this one, even just in my sound system. And I just think it was a fantastic outing. And it's just a shame it wasn't on the big screen.
Man, there's some fun set pieces in here too, especially like the initial drop. In fact, I'm a little irksome that you see the initial drop in the opening shot.
Yeah, that part was weird.
And then
like,
you
why would you pre-tell something?
Yeah, I really didn't like that at all. That was a whiff. But they basically open with a shot, and then you go back to present day, and then it comes back to that shot like maybe 10, 15 minutes later. It's not even that long. 20 minutes later.
It's not needed.
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, I'm sure somebody and some executive was like, we got to have action right off the top. No, we were good. We would have been just fine. I would have liked to have had that surprise, but it is what it is. Fun movie. Yes, what Troy is saying, the last third, definitely. I mean, suspension of disbelief is important because the entire act, if you really stop to think, you're just going to be like, why are they doing that? Why that? Why are they doing that? None of that makes sense. Shouldn't they put the shot there first? there's a bunch of stuff. But overall, fun action flick and perfect for summer. So $10 of full price admission, what do you give The Tomorrow War now on Amazon Prime, Troy?
I would give it a solid 7.
Okay, and I would give it a solid 7 as well. So bam, there we go. Perfect. And from there, we're going to move into our next conversation point, which is a topic on serial killers. Back from episode 423 in January. Serial killers. That's what we're talking about. Serial killers. People that kill lots of other people. With the little things coming out, we thought it would be interesting to ask why are we fascinated by people who kill other people in film and TV, both fiction and reality. So what is it about serial killers, John, that fascinates you personally? You love true crime and you love thrillers. What is it about serial killers specifically that fascinates you?
It's something that speaks to the human condition. Like, we are the only creatures on this planet that live for scaring each other. You don't see raccoons jump out from behind the trees and be like, ha, look, it's me, Bob. And like, oh my God, Bob, woo, you got me there.
You got me it's again. Like, you got me again.
Oh man. Woo, that's so funny. It's so fucking funny, you asshole. You don't, like, that doesn't happen in wildlife. So and if it does happen, that then somebody is dying. But in real life, it's something that we can't help but look at. It's like, why can't we just drive by a car accident without looking for the head that's rolling down the side of the street? Wow, I'm getting really dark about this.
We're awful people, is what we are, is what you're sound like you're saying.
Yeah, we really are. We really must see some death and destruction, and it makes us feel better on some sort of weird connection. Yeah.
You know, I think there is something absolutely... And it's more fiction, because I feel differently with fiction than I do with like reality. When I'm watching true crime, I am disgusted. I'm disturbed. I'm horrified. Oftentimes I have to stop because I listen to true crime a lot on my runs, or I'll listen to a documentary on Netflix and just listen to it as I run, kind of thing. And that will make me stop. I have to stop because I will get so just upset or angry or whatever. But when I'm watching a movie, I'm fascinated. Absolutely fascinated that, like, I'm captivated about a person who is killing repeatedly and they're always taunting the police. So part of me wants to see if I can figure it out before the movie tells me who, because, you know, it's usually somebody that you've already met, like somebody who's hidden in the crowd. So it's also kind of a mystery. And it's fascinating to me. Like, why do you do it? It's the psychology of it. You know, Manny, you have a bachelor's in psychology. I'm just gonna throw that out there. You love to tell people. I'm tell everybody too.
I didn't know I do, what? But okay.
Here, let me pick this up for you. You just dropped it.
why do you get fascinated with that? Because I would think at some point you've been studying it for so long, don't you just not want anything to do with it?
No.
In a fictional standpoint, because I'm sure so much of it is like, oh God, that's not real psychology.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the same true crime galore that a lot of people do now. Like, it is very trendy to be in and listening to true crime podcasts because you have to know all about it. The things that I guess I would say I'm not on board with are the ones that just try to make it too fun. And that's not a stab at anyone in particular. It's just... I don't think that that's necessarily why we shouldn't be glamorizing
true
crime in general.
I don't like when they joke about it.
And so making fun with it, even if it's just in a podcast or a YouTube channel or something, that rubs me the wrong way. But I think it's just like John said, it's human nature for us to have that curiosity, because so much of our lives are spent trying to make sense of the world, make sense of our experiences, make sense of each other's minds and feelings. And some of us are maybe over analytical in terms of those things. So when you don't comprehend why something has happened, how someone could think so differently than you or be so differently than you or anything you've experienced, your mind has a hard time trying to come to terms and understand it. And so that's really what the driving factor is curiosity. You know, you want to learn more. You want to understand them. You want to know how they could do something so brutal and vicious, because that's not, quote unquote, how humans are built.
Well, I disagree with that. I think it's completely how humans
are built. That's a whole debate. Some people don't believe that, but there are a lot of, you know, just casual viewers who think of the brutality of murder as something that's so immoral and outside of the realm of natural human nature that it has to come from either a break in their mental state or something from their environment that has influenced them that way. And in some cases it is, but in some cases it's not.
A theory that I'm playing with in my head at the moment is that through the 70s, 80s, 90s, the aughts, and a good chunk of the 2010s, there is a good amount of glamorizing serial killers, whether it's in news, documentary, and movies, whatever you want to pull out. There's always this glamorizing about, this man, this hunter of men who goes out and he overwhelms people and he outsmarts the police. But recently what I've really started to enjoy is seeing what those people are really like. Like there's the Ted Bundy thing that came out last year or the year before, where it shows that like Ted Bundy was just somebody who was ultimately really lucky. And that's all it really was, because when he was his back up against the wall, he was a problem for himself. And it's amazing to see that he was able to even function to the level he was, because he couldn't get out of his own way as far as how, like, just obvious there was something wrong with him.
Yeah, but I get, and I don't know if this is comfortable or sad or just wrong to say, but I get fascinated, and not in a good way. Like, it's not something where I'm like, oh, that's really cool, I'm going to learn how to do it. I'm fascinated by the concept of people that could get away with these horrible things for so long, and they're just that much smarter than everybody else. And yes, there are cases like Bundy where you just got lucky. I mean, it was the 70s and early 80s. You know, forensics wasn't there. There's nobody to catch you, you know, that sort of thing. Like, you got lucky for a big portion of it. But then there are other people where it's just, I mean, you got caught like a fluke. I mean, Son of Sam, Night Stalker, complete fluke, mistake. And then there's people like Golden State Killer. I mean, that guy did get away with it for 30, 40 years. And he, did 60, 70 horrible acts to 60, 70 different people and never got caught? I mean, there's something about that, because I think we're all afraid of it, right? I remember growing up, nobody ever had that fear. That's when really serial killers started to become seemingly prominent, was like the 70s and the 80s. That's really when they started popping up, for whatever the reasons are. Maybe it's cultural evolution, whatever. What's that?
Lead paint.
Could be lead paint, microwaves. You don't know what happened. You just don't know.
Lead and gasoline.
Frozen pizza peaked, you know? So there's a lot of things that could have driven it. We don't know. But that seems to be when they were really starting to spike. There was so much anger in the world, and it just spiraled into these people that were doing these monstrous things. And it became absolutely captivating and fascinating, while also despicable, but really captivating. I remember when Ted Bundy got caught, and then they made a miniseries, because Mark Harmon was in that miniseries. I think it was The Deliberate Stranger, if I remember the right. And I watched it with my mom. My mom, she's knee-deep in psychology, too. Like, psychology is a thing around here in the Chicago area. And watching that with someone who appreciated that and understood that was a fascinating dynamic. But at the same time, we're both watching it with, like, that guy's kind of cool. And not in the he's cool because he's a killer. It's like he seems like a cool person. How could he possibly do those things? And that's when you get even more fascinated. You're like, why would somebody, that guy, handsome, seemed to have everything going for him. He had an Ivy League college or whatever. I mean, he was fine. His life was going to be just fine. And he just had this urge to kill people. Why? Why? And you just were captivated by it. And every performance I see where you have an actor that's actually playing with that and doing something different, you know, even not very good actors have done really good things. Like Judd Nelson was great in Relentless, which is not something anybody ever talks about, but he's a great serial killer in that movie. It's just, it's a fascinating thing. And I wish to God I could explain it, because it's probably horrible that you feel that, or that I feel that way.
Well, I mean, that speaks to the interest of mystery for you specifically.
You're
intrigued by trying to put the pieces together and solve the puzzle, whereas other people might not be as fascinated with trying to figure out who the killer is and beat the police investigation, or, you know, make sure you can sort it out in your mind, almost like a challenge. Other people are innately interested in learning something that they didn't know. And when it comes to true crime, you learn so much. You learn about humans, you learn about relationships, you learn about, you know, safeguards in your home and stuff. You learn about police investigation procedures. You learn about so much. And when you have that much to explore and your mind can continue to go down this rabbit hole, it's really hard to stop that. And especially when we don't have usually very clear and concise answers to it. So it's still kind of like left open as a mystery. Even with all of the serial killers that have been caught and they've established their reasons, there's still so many lingering questions. You know, even if it's about, were there people that weren't found that they murdered or, oh, you know, raped, you know, or something, are, or whatever. Right?
They're not going to own up to everything.
Some of them do, because
how many you got? 16? I killed 16. Crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Definitely 16, not more.
Oh, you got 18? All right, I forgot those two. I was tired at one time. Do you guys have a memory of a fictional one? I don't mean, you know, a true crime one, a fictional portrayal of a serial killer where it haunted you after you saw it, or bothered you, got under your skin. If I, like, for example, you know, everybody talks about Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter, right? Everybody talks about Hannibal Lecter. He's great, which he is. He's great. But on the same token, Buffalo Bill is the one that freaked me out.
Put the lotion in the basket.
You know, when he does that whole little dance and just everything about it's just horrifying. It's like, that guy is probably out there, and that scares me.
The one I think of is Peter Cushing from Copycat.
I don't get why you love that one. He's so, maybe it's because he's so normal. Maybe that's what it is.
That's exactly right. Okay. That's what makes him such a problem. He's, you know, the actor himself is actually somewhat of an attractive guy. He is able to blend into a situation. And then as you're watching the movie, you realize he's kind of everywhere in her life. And you don't pay attention to it the first time.
Yeah.
You know, when she's first attacked, he's actually in the audience of that whole seminar where Harry Connick Jr. attacks her in the bathroom. So there's a lot of things in that movie. And because Peter Cushing is such, like, again, he is somebody who blends in and was able to get as close to somebody as possible. And also, again, killed a lot of people and nobody suspected anything from him.
I wouldn't say that this one haunted me, but it did sit with me because it was more, it was so grounded in the potential of reality. And that would be American Psycho, where he's basically this really handsome, nice guy. And there's debate on if he actually did it or if it's all in his mind. But still, let's talk about the actual killer moments. He's so crazy in it. And you can't understand how someone who seemingly has all of the great things, like you said earlier, Aaron, could do something so menacing. And that one sits with me more so because I know there have been real serial killers in the United States that have been those handsome, charming guys and have murdered and hurt many people because people were unsuspecting.
Yeah.
And so those are the ones that are really more scary to me than the gruesome faced ones or something. It's the people that I could see working at the bank or living next door or, you know, the mailman or something. Just obscure, normal people that you wouldn't typically picture to be a murderer.
Hey, so I just want to cut in on something real quick that she said. Patrick Bateman from American Psycho. Handsome, yes. Successful, yes. Nice? No.
Okay, no, he was, but he still had a level of charm to him when he wanted something.
He was kind of smarmy and just so full of himself. He was not a nice guy.
But there were when that movie came out, that was the thing. Women loved men that were a little bit full of themselves and had a
rich,
level of arrogance.
Handsome, power broker, confident. Yeah. He was a popular figure.
Gross.
I just want to make sure we all understand he wasn't nice.
I just want to make sure we all understand that. Can you really suspend disbelief to picture like a rich, successful executive, you know, killing somebody to get ahead? I don't doubt that, especially with Huey Lewis blaring in the background. I have no doubts this happens. None.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and somebody covers it up. And also, I will say, you know, John Doe, I know we can't talk about Kevin Spacey anymore, but John Doe is one where it really unnerved me because he got so... I don't know what it was, but they did such a wonderful job of like framing that movie, how Fincher shot the movie, how he waited to really present the killer until the end. So he's really, he's an ominous figure the entire movie. When they come across him, you don't get to see his face. You know, you're following him like they're following him. And it just made him more menacing. And then when you see him and then he has that monologue in the back of the police car and everything he says is true is like, you only caught me because I let you. And it makes you think like, that's a lot of killers. Like there are a lot of people that have done this and gotten away with it. So it kind of really hit a nerve too. That whole, plus got to the guy's wife. Eesh, it's not good. What's the box? So it's easy to get seduced by a wonderful performance, but do you have a different reaction to watching an actor terrify us versus a documentary on the real thing? Like I talked about that, like Bundy Dahmer, when you hear or watch real serial killers in action, does that terrify you more or it's really just about the same?
When I see you're talking like fictional character versus non-fictional character, essentially.
Yeah. Real serial killer versus portrayed on
documentary
TV.
Versus fictional.
Yeah.
So when I see a fictional serial killer, I am more enamored by it. I can have more fun with it. I can, because I know it's not real. Yeah. And it's
cool.
It's,
kill it's, stuff like that.
Yeah. You can, you feel like you have a level of enjoyment with it as morbid as that is. A lot of us who enjoy thriller and horror films enjoy the creativity of a serial killer and the way that they murder or plan things out or whatever your interest is in. And I can get that, but I would never feel the same way about a real serial killer in a documentary. I wouldn't say, wow, they planned that out so well. I'm very impressed and good job for you. That was an amazing kill, how you just decided to like skin their head off or something or like their back. It becomes more grotesque and it becomes more bone chilling. And it also makes me look over my shoulder a bit more when it's a documentary. It makes me question the people in my reality, whereas a fictional character is something that's, I don't want to say jovial, but sometimes they can be fun.
When you
like
see someone that's handsome like Patrick Bateman, you're like, get away. Get away. 20 feet at least. Keep away. Can I help you with that? No. I will drop these things. It's fine.
Yeah. And it's almost like you can say that they're handsome when they're not a real serial killer, when they're a fictional character. Like in Scream, I can say, yeah, he's cute. But
no, Skeet Ulrich.
Yeah, he's cute.
I can get that. But Ted Bundy, you know, even though you know he's a good looking guy, you just feel dirty even saying that.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
like,
yeah, he's handsome. Ugh. And they always.
Jeremy Renner played him once.
What's that?
He is Jeremy Renner played him once. One of my favorite performers
Grumpy Cat's not handsome?
No, he's not. He does look like Grumpy Cat. His face is very Grumpy Cat-ish.
Okay.
He's a decent looking guy, not in that movie.
I mean, if your options are limited, sure.
This is a weird conversation already.
Go ahead. Sorry, I don't want to put him in a Hurt Locker. What are you trying to say, Amanda?
Oh, no, to his point, I was just going to say that's Jeremy Renner's portrayal as Jeffrey Dahmer was actually one of my more favorite ones. Because
that, my friend Dahmer or something like that, right? Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yep. I have not seen that one. Is that a good movie?
I think it's streaming. I thought it was a pretty decent movie. I mean, it's not anything that's going to rock your world or anything. And you probably know most of the stuff that's in the film.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable how much I know about that.
It does make it's a little unsettling because it just seems like a normal guy and you're just following his path until you're like, oh. So I think it's more enjoyable for people who don't really know much about Jeffrey Dahmer.
Have you ever seen an interview with Dahmer? Like a real interview? There aren't many,
yeah.
But he is kind of a regular guy. And it's very uncomfortable because if you just like walked in the house and somebody had that on TV and you just heard him talking, you're like, oh, who's this dude? And then he's like, well, then I had put his head in a jar. Wait, what? What? Like, you just don't see it coming. I mean, you can kind of almost see how he used that to his advantage. And that's even more terrifying, I think. What about you, John? Do you get more nerved by real ones or about the same?
I find the fake ones to be much more interesting to watch because you see those actors make the decision to say, hey, we're going to make this more about it being a predator. And you're seeing somebody who is trying to put themselves in a position. And of course, they can't help but glamorize bits and pieces of it. When I watch like a documentary on Dahmer or a documentary on Bundy or any of these other ones, I spend a lot of time going like, okay, and this is when they caught him, right?
Mm-hmm.
No. How did you guys miss him? Okay, wait. This is when you caught him. He is out in the open doing something. He's being stupid. How did you guys miss him this time? Okay, now this is, and that's what I spend most of the time like focusing on, is just the absurdity of every situation. Because it's almost always some absurd situation as to what helps these guys continue to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And I just bang my head against the wall about that whole thing.
Yeah, one thing I find, the more and more of them that I've seen, is when a really great performance of a serial killer by an actor is when they underplay it. I really don't like Anthony Hopkins was just brilliant in terms of the fact that he seems so unassuming for a great portion of that movie, which is what makes him more uncomfortable and more unnerving to us.
Right.
But most actors would overplay that. I would actually say, you know, Brian Cox in Manhunter does a completely different take, but a very similar take on how he underplays Hannibal Lecter in Manhunter. And anytime an actor does that, to me, that feels like, okay, that's more what a serial killer is like, because they're not making bold choices. They're not making bright mistakes that should be caught, you know, because they're being so dramatic or they're making an obvious slip up or something like that. Because an actor has a tendency to want to go big in these kinds of roles.
Even Mads Mikkelsen, same character, but he was nearly superhuman when Mads Mikkelsen was playing him.
Oh my God. And I can't, this bugs me, right? This is a legitimate criticism of about every serial killer movie that does this. When they constantly drop their little hints to that they're a killer, like, oh no, what are we having for dinner? You know, I bet you taste marvelous. You know, stuff like that. Just random nonsense like that. A real serial killer would do everything they could to mask that because they've been practicing. So to me, that just screams lazy writing. And it feels like, okay, you're trying to hint to the audience that, ooh, maybe they're going to catch him. I don't like it. I just don't like that aspect.
No. Right.
But real ones can terrify me. Some of them, I'm just like, wow, you're so dumb. I don't know how you got that far. Like, you just, because Ted Bundy is an idiot. Like, when you really watch the documentary, you kind of feel like you're a lucky idiot.
Oh, all of them are lucky idiots. Dahmer was another case of like, you know, poor kid got away from Dahmer. Cops caught the kid.
Oh, that's a horrible story.
And Dahmer shows up and like the kid's all got a drill, you know, a drill bit sticking out of his head and everything. And Dahmer's like, oh, my boyfriend and I were having a fight. And the cops were like, ooh, let the gay guys walk away while we don't touch it and get the gay on us.
That guy should have been charged, by the way. The cop should have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He should have been. That's a whole different story. But in terms of watching the real ones, like I just watched the Night Stalker documentary on Netflix. And they do a really good job because they kind of keep the actual killer until the very last episode. And it's even It's really horrifying. Like, he's one of the most uncomfortable serial killers in history just because of how unempathetic he is as a character. He just loved the attention. And then the women that were just throwing themselves at him, I'm just like, what? I don't get that. That's a weird thing.
The guy had a graveyard for a mouth.
Oh my God. He's horrible. He opened his mouth and you would literally be terrified. You know, it's not a matter of braces. He needs an entire mouth. Just get a new mouth. Yeah. But when his mouth's closed, he's kind of a handsome guy from afar, I would say. I mean, maybe he has an allure, I think, to him. But as soon as he opens his mouth, the frickin' devil. Just terrifying. Whew. All right. So what stands out to you? We talked about a few of them. But what stands out to you as your other favorite performances in serial killer films and television?
The first one I can think of off the top of my head is Dan Stevens in The Guest.
Yeah, I guess he would be a serial killer, right?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. He went from house to house. He took over lives and he lied to them. And again, as somebody who's very unassuming and getting themselves into stuff. And he's one of those charming monsters that is hard to get away from.
That bar scene when he beats the shit out of those kids.
Yeah.
One of my favorite movie scenes in the last 20 years, sincerely. Because it's just so, he's so charming. And then he just beats the shit out of everybody.
Yeah. Another one that really pops to mind is Charlize Theron in Monster. Oh,
great one.
The Eileen Wuornos story.
Yep. Great one.
Oh, my God. Like, it's so hard to watch that movie and go, that's Charlize Theron. Because she completely disappears into that role. And she, you know, anything you know about looking at her being one of the most beautiful women in Hollywood, when you see her in that role, you're just like, what am I looking at? Because that's all her.
What that reminded me, like, her performance was so raw. It reminded me a lot of, like, Henry Rooker and Henry. Did you ever see Henry? I don't know if you ever saw that one. But
I don't know if I did either. I don't think so.
Henry Rooker played a serial killer. It's called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer. Very disturbing movie. Her monster, kind of similar, but Michael Rooker just looks like Michael Rooker. So the transformation for him is, you know, it's like literally one step. He just walked in the door.
Right.
Hers is about 48 steps to get from what she looks like to make herself look like that horrible, horrible person. She deserved the Oscar for sure.
Yeah, she really did. She was amazing. And then finally, again, like I already mentioned him once, but William McNamara's Peter Cushing from Copycat. Again, I think he's pretty great just because he's really what a serial killer is.
All right. Amanda, what do you got?
One from television that's popped into my mind, and it's a more recent one, is Martin Whitley from Prodigal Son, played by Martin Sheen.
Oh, he's so good in that. I just
watched
the episode today.
He is excellent.
At my lunch, I was watching that. That's so good.
Yeah, I really, really like the way he portrays his character because he has a level of, it's just some sort of dynamic that he has where he has compassion and love for his children, but he also aches for them to be different, but he also really likes when they're murderers or they do something bad and it's some way for them to bond. And he is very satisfied killing people, and he's feels glory in the fact that he knows he's good at that. And it's just very haunting. I do feel whenever someone gets close enough to a serial killer and it starts to make me feel uneasy about their safety, mm-hmm. That's how I know that is a terrifying character.
He is so good about going from, because he's such a kind of like a lovey grandpa uncle kind of character. I mean, actor. I mean, he's just so, he's kind of frumpy and he just seems so approachable. But when he snaps in that show, he doesn't do it very often in that show, but when he snaps, it is horrifying. Like, he's so good. He is so good.
Yeah.
What else you got? What about Dexter? I mean, you're a huge Dexter fan.
Yeah, I do love Dexter. I have a very conflicted feeling about him because I'm so sympathetic to him. Because
it's so weird when you're rooting for the serial killer, right? You're like,
good
job, buddy.
It's bad because I don't always feel like he's the bad guy. Like, he's taking out for generally bad people. And so it's like, I don't know. It's fictional. It's not really that bad if he's taking out the bad guys for us. But I don't know. I mean, as a serial killer and his techniques and everything about him, I think he is what we all envision a well-rounded serial killer to be. You know, he has everything that's pristine. He has a process. He knows the cleanup. He knows how to handle everything. And he'll dismember you and nobody will find you. And that's what we envision when we think about a successful serial killer.
I don't know if
successful. I just want to point out the phrase well-rounded serial killer was uttered.
I know. Somebody is going to just make my life.
I remember that quote. In that show when he killed, what was the character's name? Dokes? Was that his name? And
oh, God.
The cop.
And it, surprise, yeah. Motherfucker. Yeah.
And you're like rooting for Dexter. And it's the worst thing ever. He's like, oh, man, I hope you get him, Dexter. And then you're like, wait, but he's actually in the complete right. Dokes is absolutely 100% in the right. Why am I rooting for the awful serial killer? But Michael C. Hall, just, man, he is so good in that role. He really, really is.
Yep.
You know,
he's perfect for him.
There is another one who we don't have confirmation is classified as a serial killer, only a murderer at this point. But I have a feeling this person has at least gone on, it's a fictional character, has gone on to be a serial killer. And that is Amy from Gone Girl. She is terrifying. And I know she only had a couple murders in the movie, right? Because she killed Desi.
Just one.
Okay, well, okay. So she only had one, which is why I said she's not a serial killer. But I imagine she has done more and will do more, though we don't have confirmation of it. And she is the type of person where I can see she's so manipulative and well planned out that's okay, you crazy.
Look at it. Look at Amanda trying
to. That chick terrifies me.
Right?
She does. But I don't think she qualifies. She's not a serial killer.
She's not a serial killer.
She's not a serial killer.
I did preface and say that she is not, right. But I feel right. Like she has gone on. Nick's probably dead, let's be honest.
Well, I guess I'm guessing your list is done if you're going to people that aren't serial killers. So we
I tried to go with one, okay? Usually I don't get to pick more than one.
It says performances, plural.
Yeah, it says plural. Exactly. That's on you. And I would throw Dexter, John Lithgow as really good.
Oh, he was fantastic.
Yeah, he was really great too.
I will say Jigsaw, just because I really like how kind of almost laid back he plays it when he's on there.
Yeah.
Would you like to play a game?
And he's just planning, just working it out. You know, he's just laying there the whole time. The first movie, he doesn't even do anything. Really, he's just chill. So I thought that was great.
I want to point out something. He always says, "Would you like to play a game?" But you're already in the game by the time he asks you that question. So he's not really giving you much of a choice.
It's rhetorical.
It's a total cheat move. It's a total cheat move. He's like the worst guy to play Monopoly with. He's got money in his pocket.
Really?
Yeah, guaranteed.
Yeah, because I would be like, every single day, you want to play a game? No, I don't. No,
I'm done. I'm good. Well, here's what you got to do if you want to live. I'm like, that's not, I literally said I don't want to play. So you are a cheating bastard. Other ones, this is a real big, I'm a big fan of The Collector. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but there's
Bone Collector,
No, not The Bone Collector. The Collector.
Yeah.
It's totally different movie. That's the one, and there's a sequel called The Collection. But the first one is The Collector, and it's basically a burglar breaks into a house, and when he gets in, he finds out that there's a serial killer already in the house, and he has to decide if he can get the people that are in there out safely, or if he just saves his own ass before the serial killer finds him. And both movies are, I love them to death. Like, they're fun little thrillers that nobody talks about, but I absolutely love those movies. And he's a great serial killer because it scares the shit out of me every time he comes on screen. So check that one out if you can find it, The Collector. Norman Bates, obvious one. And then lastly, it's an older movie, Robert Mitchum's Harry Powell and the Night of the Hunter. Just a really great classic serial killer. So those are mine. Do you guys have a favorite documentary in this subject? That's a little harder of a question, I think.
I think most recently, my favorite documentary is Don't Fuck with Cats.
Oh, that was so disturbing.
Oh, yeah. That was excellent. Good choice. Yeah.
There's a lot of reasons why it's great. The killer himself isn't the reason why it's great, but the process in which they went through in catching him and how they peeled that onion is really interesting to pay attention to.
How like the social media and stuff helped them catch him.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that was disturbing.
I will say, you know, it's you don't know who the killers are often, but because it's not serial killer. That's just murderers. That's different. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Well, I'm glad we're here to have you talk yourself out of
it. I know. I was like, wait a second. They're going to tell me that doesn't qualify, and then I'm just going to have to backtrack anyway.
I'll give you a real documentary. This is The Zodiac. It's about the Zodiac Killer. Find it. Watch it.
Oh, that's another good serial killer movie.
Fascinatingly detailed. Movie's very good, too. But there's a movie called The Town That Dreaded Sundown, and it's shot like a documentary, but it's not. But much of it is real. But also there's stuff that's not. So it's like real facts and it's fictional. And it's like this hodgepodge of a film that kind of comes across a little bit like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and that it's meant to be real gritty and realistic in many ways. It's not technically a documentary, but there's a lot of real truths in there. But it horrified me as a kid. Absolutely horrified me, because most of what happens in there is true. And that's just one that came to mind. Okay, that was serial killers, and now we are going to move into our final topic of this particular episode, which is great movie plots that just went wrong. And keep in mind, before we get there, you can always find more information about The Hollywood Outsider at thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's thehollywoodoutsider.com. We always appreciate your feedback. You can let us know what you think of the show or anything else at feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. That's feedback@thehollywoodoutsider.com. Let's get into great movie plots that went wrong. This week, we're going to make it pretty simple. Great movie plots or premises that just didn't work. We each have three from a series, whatever. We have three examples of great movie plots we felt that just didn't work. And then we're kind of going to go bullet point through a bunch of listener choices, and kind of we'll just take a vote on if we agree or not. So let's start with John, Amanda, then myself. And we'll start with Round Robin. What's your first great movie plot that just didn't work, and why?
If I told you that we're going to make a movie about one of the most interesting Marvel characters there possibly is, what would you have to say?
Just make sure Uncle Ben is in it.
Well, anyhow, this is Wolverine, so no Uncle Ben. If there is Uncle Ben, he's actually the one making rice. But, wow. You know, X-Men Origins Wolverine. Great idea. The comic that it's based off of is awesome. You get to find out, like, Logan growing up, what is going on with his life, how he got to where he is. And the movie sort of does that, but it takes all the teeth out of it.
Okay. And I think we're all going to have a little bit of a difference on some of these, but I like that movie because I think the benefit is that I don't know the comic. I don't know Wolverine as a comic. I don't know the information. So I dig that movie. And I still like the little twist with the wife. I think that's a fun twist. And plus, you see his ass, and a lot of women like that. A lot of men like that. I like that.
I mean, a lot of everybody likes that. Yeah. I'm with Aaron, though. I think there's a benefit sometimes to not knowing the original properties, because you can be blissfully unaware. And, exactly. And that's where I sit.
We're stupid.
Yeah, we're stupid. We are stupid. I was trying to give us like a nicer phrasing, but stupid works, too.
And maybe I don't understand the premise of the question, but the movie brings in some things.
You're not wrong. Huh? Everyone in the world agrees.
There's
with
a lot
you.
Of people. Yeah, yeah. There's all a right. lot of people who are on your side. Please, we're in the minority.
Please do not misunderstand that as we're saying you're wrong. You are not wrong, my friend. You are dead right. we have different taste, and we are allowing a lot of things to slide. That's what I would say.
Okay. Because like the whole Taylor Kitsch Taylor Kitsch as
I liked him as Gambit. I did.
Yeah, I like the actor, and I liked the idea of him being Gambit. The execution of it was just way too not Gambit for me.
The only thing in that movie I really hated will be the obvious thing, which is Deadpool. It's just awfully done. It has zero to do. I mean, I like him at the beginning when he's Wade Wilson, but it has zero to do with the character of Deadpool. I don't even understand that choice. That's the only thing I really don't like.
All right. I think we're in agreement then.
Sure. All right, Amanda, what's your first bad or great movie premise that but turned wasn't a great movie.
So I decided to go with Green Lantern, keeping on the superhero concept.
Oh, all three of our first ones are just going to connect. I like it.
Yeah. To give a synopsis of the movie, a reckless test pilot, Hal Jordan, is granted an alien ring that bestows him with otherworldly powers that inducts him into an intergalactic police force, the Green Lantern Corps. Now, in theory, Green Lantern should be awesome. Green Lantern should be fun, but mm-hmm. Green Lantern, and to cite an individual who has been a guest on The Hollywood Outsider and who is a host on Smirk, Zach Parkerson, he says that Green Lantern should be Star Wars meets The Lord of the Rings in a superhero universe. And I think for most people, that's like, heck yeah, I want that. That mm-hmm. is not what we got. We did not get that. We got horrible. I mean, whoever decided that we should just CGI the costume instead of just making a real costume just made poor decisions.
I'm convinced that was all of the people that had seen Ryan Reynolds, you know, without a shirt on. And they were all like, we could get this for like 3 months. Oh, just yeah. do a CGI suit, guy. CGI suit. Let's do that.
And he also was probably not the best cast for that.
I
mean,
he was bad. I don't think.
What?
No, yeah, but
he's great. But no, he was not the problem in that movie.
He is not the problem in that movie whatsoever.
He is not the representation of Green Lantern as a character. He is not supposed to be that smarmy.
I think.
Yes, he is.
Every character.
No, he's not.
No, he's not, John. He's not in the comics.
He's not supposed to be that smarmy. So while we love Ryan Reynolds, and I'm on 100% board with that. That was just not the best pick for Green Lantern. And I'm just a little disappointed because after learning more about the character and the world and the comics, this could have been something really great.
I agree it could have been something great. I don't agree that I think Ryan Reynolds can play just about anything, and I'm all for it. My problem with this is it was just too much CGI. It was like a blender of CGI and none of it made sense. It's just like, let's make everything. Why? Because Green Lanterns can do that. Okay.
And so many villains.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, it didn't know what it wanted to be, and it had too much going on. Ryan Reynolds was not the problem. However, it would have been a great movie for Nathan Fillion to be Green Lantern. He does play Green Lantern in some of the animated stuff.
Oh, I actually did not know that.
I didn't care.
This would be, I think we have to keep in mind, though, this was before, like, the big superhero combustion of everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they didn't have, like, a real working, I mean, to be fair, they don't really have a great working yet. Anyway, but there wasn't a good map out of what a superhero movie should be like at this point. So I think if they were to do that now, there would be much more clear direction on how to translate the comics into a film.
Well, they're getting an HBO Max series now, so that should be really good.
Yeah.
That should be interesting. Mine connect because 6 degrees of Ryan Reynolds. The first row is all Ryan Reynolds bombs. No, just kidding. Just kidding. It connects to Wolverine. That's how it connects. X-Men The Last Stand and Dark Phoenix. I am saying both of them. And I actually like...
Can you do this?
I can do whatever I want. So
it's kind of his show.
That's true.
I never said you couldn't, but it's the same plot. So that's why I'm saying it's the same plot. The Dark Phoenix storyline, one of the best story, I know this one, and one of the best storylines in comics. It's a fantastic story. And while I kind of enjoyed the Dark Phoenix version, I did not enjoy The Last Stand in any aspect. The truth remains that Fox had two chances to nail the storyline of how Jean Grey became the Phoenix, and neither time could they make it land. I just don't know why is it that difficult to make it right. I think it needs two movies probably, and Apocalypse should have been the first movie. That's what I think. But it's just wasted opportunity because that's a great storyline. John, you're more the comic guru on our show. Do you agree with that? Do you feel like...
Oh, it's a super heavy, awesome comic storyline. So it could have been done so much better than what we got either time. But what... it's one of those stories that definitely does not fit into the span of however long you're going to make a movie, because it needs to be hollowed out. It needs to be solided up quite a bit more than what they did, where they're just kind of skirting along being like, here's some random reasons why this is working the way it is, and let's just kind of sprinkle it in and let you figure it out. Instead of, it really needs to have that story put front and center and good just grounding, and neither movie did a good job of doing that.
So I didn't see Dark Phoenix because that just came out, 2-3 years ago or something, and I just never watched it.
Mm-hmm. You're not the only one.
But I will say, and I know I'm in the minority, almost all of the X-Men movies I've been a fan of.
Even The Last Stand.
There's something about them. I don't know why. I don't know why I'm such a fan of the X-Men movies. And I can recognize that there are some failures. I mean, that's clear. But I still like them.
Well, it's okay to be a fan of these things and still sit there and be able to say, hey, this is something I really like, because I think Aaron and I are both going to end up doing this in this conversation. Mm-hmm. But we can both go, this is something I really like. Here are some problems.
Yeah. And that's where I'm at with this. I know there's problems, but I still like it.
You know, you can easily go, Jordan Peele is a great director. He doesn't have to be the greatest director in the entire generation.
And nobody has said that.
But he's just pretty good. It's okay. I really like him. I like what he does.
John, what is your number two great movie plot that didn't work out?
Oh, speaking of that.
Mm.
All right. We're going to take two of the big powerhouses from DC. We're going to slap them in a movie together. And then we're going to cut the movie into pieces so that you don't understand why they're fighting. And that's Batman versus Superman. And I'm going to talk about primarily the theatrical release, because that's the one that technically counts. Because if you watch the extended cut, the story makes 10% more sense.
Maybe 50.
But
huh? Maybe 50.
Maybe 50. But I remember watching this in the theater, and at 2/3, maybe 4/3 of the movie, I don't know how many thirds there are in something, but it didn't matter, because halfway through it, I'm going, but why? Why are they fighting?
Why are they mad at each other?
Why
is Granny's pee jar going on the counter?
You know, there are just so many things that they just like really crapped the bed on as far as what they messed up in that movie. And I shouldn't have spent so much time asking, but why? And I've been saying this for years about that movie, especially the theatrical release. I never understood how they cut that movie so thinly that you never understood in the theater release that until the very end, Lex Luthor was kind of playing the two of them like puppets.
Yeah, which works better in the ultimate cut. When you see, which I'll never understand, when you're making a movie this huge, why wouldn't that be the cut that got released to begin with?
Right.
It's 3 hours.
Seriously.
They've proved that an opus like, you know, Avengers Endgame and that sort of Infinity War, they can be 3 hours and people will still sit in their ass in seats. Lord of the Rings proved it 20 years ago. People will sit if you make it good enough. And that would have been a better movie.
It
just would have been.
Oh, man. There was one other thing I wanted to bring up, but I just forgot what it was.
Is it about Jesse Eisenberg's casting? Because that's what I was going to bring up.
No, I'm fine with that. But go ahead.
You should not be. So... You're bringing up that movie, and I am a fan of that movie. I will defend that movie. Martha, I won't defend as much, but I get it. I just don't think it works as well as Snyder keeps telling everybody it does.
No, but it's hilarious at this point.
Yeah, it's all meme at this point. It's all gif. I mean, it basically just runs the gamut. But I will honestly say I think Zack Snyder has one of the most inspired casting minds of any director working. I firmly believe that. There's a lot of actors I never would have expected to be in the roles that they were in who just dominated. You know, look at the comedian in Watchmen. Look at Aquaman, Jason Momoa. Look at Gal Gadot. Never, for most people, she doesn't fit that bill. You know, they wanted someone more curvy. They wanted whatever. They wanted something. You know, and so I think he's really, really talented at picking the right person for a part. With the really strong exception of Jesse Eisenberg, I really thought he was going for something more bold that didn't work. And I know Cranston was on the table at one point. Just think in your mind, John, how much better that movie would have been if Lex Luthor was Bryan Cranston. Just think.
Yeah, you got me on that one. You definitely got me on that one.
It's just like one of the biggest misses in casting. I just think would have completely turned reaction to that movie around.
My only other problem with that movie is the actual fight between Batman and Superman.
Should have been 30 seconds long.
It should have been like Superman saying, okay, so this is what I just figured out. Lex Luthor, and the whole time Superman's talking, Batman could be punching him and doing absolutely nothing to him.
Yes.
And, you know, just like, so look, okay, just get it out of your system. But look, this is what's going on. This is what I figured out. This is how I figured it out. This is what he just told me. He's got my mom. Her name is Martha. You might like that. You know, he could have been saying all these things, and the whole time, like, Bruce Wayne's just getting tired. You know, that's what the whole fight should have been. There should have been no reason for Batman to just get annoyed at a human who's trying to hit him and be like, okay, now I'm annoyed and I'm going to accidentally throw you through a building.
Okay, that's fair. You're right. I don't disagree with that. It's kind of like Godzilla versus Kong. I don't see how Kong has a shot. I just don't. I just don't, but we'll see how that plays out.
Save Mothra.
All right, Amanda,
how do you know that name?
What's your number two?
My number two is a movie that I hate with all of my being, but I went into mildly excited, if you will, just because of the director. And it is now my least favorite movie that has ever been made, and that is Lady in the Water.
Okay.
So the concept about, I mean, the film is about this superintendent who thinks he's rescuing a young woman from a pool, and he ends up finding out that she's actually a character from a bedtime story that's trying to make it back home, and he works with his tenants to protect this woman from creatures that are trying to keep her in our world. And the concept seems like it would be so cool and fantasy like, but also could be really dark and demonic,
like Splash or Shape of Water, like something around
just something that actually does something with the story.
Sure.
Whereas Lady in the Water does nothing. I mean, literally, it does not do anything with the plot, and it just, none of it works, none of it makes sense. It was such a disappointment. Because you know who's attached to it. You know who should be making this something good, and it failed on so many levels. I know I've talked about Lady in the Water being a terrible movie, but what do you guys think of Lady in the Water?
No, it's a terrible movie. I'm with you, okay. 100%. Yeah, you know, the only surprise ending for that movie was, it's over? Oh, God, I'm so surprised. Thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Thank God we can leave.
Yeah.
I kind of love the movie.
Yeah, you would.
What?
You would. You just,
I really love the story. Like, the guy, he thinks he's nothing, but he's trying to help her, and he thinks it becomes his job to just like find all the people who are more important to saving her and putting them together. But it turns out that that's not his job at all. But he's actually ends up being more important to her whole life than he ever expected. I mean, I just think there's something great and beautiful about that. Where he's just somebody who thinks he's nothing, and it turns out he's a lot more than that.
Thank you for selling my point, John. This could be such a great concept, and it could work on so many levels, but it failed to do so. But I'm glad that you extracted the positive elements of the story.
Yeah, everything.
Yeah, it worked for me.
Everything John said was the movie I thought I was getting.
Yeah, right.
I didn't see any of that. So I don't know if you just heard the plot and then you fell asleep. So then in your mind, because you're a creative fella, you know, you're an artist. I don't know. Maybe in your mind, you just saw the movie that should have been made, because that's not the movie I saw. The movie I saw just sucked.
I purposely sat down and rewatched this movie a couple times.
Shame on you.
Why would you purposefully do that to yourself? Yeah.
Because I really like it. It makes me happy.
I'm not going to shame you for liking the movie.
I will. I will. Give me time.
This is supposed to be a safe place, Aaron.
Give me time. All right. Well, my next one is Escape from LA.
Oh.
It's one of the greatest missed opportunities in film for me. I mean, and I love this movie. Shamefully love this movie despite its flaws. I know organically this is a bad film. So no one needs to write and tell me how stupid I am or how I don't get it and blah, 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 blah. I get it. Bad movie. Still like it because Kurt Russell is Snake Plissken. And I think he's one of the best characters on film in my lifetime. I'm a big fan. And the plot is about the president's daughter. This time takes a device that could shut the whole world down because essentially she's this idealist. She's being used by a thug inside LA, which is now a prison. You know, it's basically like New York, but on the other coast. And Snake is sent in to retrieve both her, maybe, if he can get her out, and this device. It's essentially a remake of Escape from New York. It's just done with a much bigger budget and a lot of stabs at LA culture. All of this should be fantastic. And there's a lot of great ideas in the movie. But had John Carpenter not been on the wrong side of his career when he made this movie, which he was on the downward slope. And had they not hired the absolute worst special effects house in film history to handle the film, this could have been a great movie. Because of those two things, John Carpenter was not on his A game. He was a few years past his prime. Kurt Russell brought it in every single, he committed to the whole movie. It's not just because I love Kurt Russell. He committed to that whole movie. And the special effects are phenomenally horrible. Just phenomenally horrible. They had a $50 million budget. If you watch this movie, you would think it was $8. And that's sad. So that had a great plot and great potential and failed in every possibility. Who's with me on Escape from LA?
I mean, I still love it, but you're probably not wrong.
I'm not going to disagree with you.
Okay, that's cool. Why don't you go watch Lady in the
Water?
I feel
like this is the most we've agreed.
Yeah. Yeah, probably.
This is weird.
Probably. All right, John, final one.
All right, so my final one, I brought it up a few times on the show for whatever bad thing that needed to be brought up, and I keep on having to bring this thing up because on paper, this movie should be perfect, with the exception of one glaring issue, which is its director and probably the guy who wrote the story. But In the Name of the King, a Dungeon Siege story.
Jason Statham one?
Jason Statham, okay. You know, you've got like one of the most amazing put together cast possible for a movie. And then you throw in Uwe Boll as the writer director. I think he wrote it. Screenwriter is Doug Taylor. And what you get is a movie where Jason Statham says all of five lines.
Not inherently at bad. All. Not inherently bad. Could be cool.
No, not
stoic,
inherently
mute, tough.
Yeah, it is. It is based off of video game property, but that's, we're not going to count that against it because it has so many things else going wrong with it, like Uwe Boll or Uwe Boll, whatever you want to call him. But, you know, the cast at the time of this release, you've got Lily Sobieski, John Rhys-Davies, Ron Perlman, Claire Forlani, Christina Locken, okay, take her reliever, Matthew Lillard, Brian White, Ray Liotta, Burt Reynolds.
Ray Liotta. Like, didn't he wear a leather jacket or something through the whole movie? I mean, didn't he?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that.
And he's got that Ray Liotta accent, you know? He just stepped out of a freaking Italian restaurant or some stuff, and, you know, hey, where's the pasta at? You know? And,
where's the
you
king
know, he's supposed
at?
To be a wizard.
Where's the king? I'll whack him.
Everything about this movie just, like, and the thing is that when I watched this movie, I sat down and ended up watching the entire thing, and everybody else I was watching this movie with went to bed. They just quit. They were like, in the first 5 minutes, they're like, we are the fuck out of here. And I stuck with it, and I want that time back because how dare they put this cast in a movie and it come out so terribly.
Yeah, I mean, I got nothing to say to any of that because it's one of the most awful movies I've ever seen. And I did not finish it. So I don't know how it ends. I don't care how it ends. I mean, you don't need to tell me. I don't really care. It's a movie that I think I made it about 30 minutes in and then just said, it's Uwe Boll again. All right. He's just doing the same thing. He just does not care. Does not give a shit.
Nope.
All righty then.
You win.
Well, my last one is In Time. In a future where people stop aging at 25 but are engineered to live only one more year, having the means to buy your way out of the situation is a shot at immortal youth. And this character finds himself accused of murder and on the run with a hostage, a connection that becomes an important part of the way against the system. Now, in theory, this is a really, really cool story.
It's very
concept.
Cool.
But it lacks depth in the concept. it really just skims the surface of it and spends too much time extrapolating on other things that don't really matter, including the love story. I think it falls too far into that. It's poorly directed. The dialogue is real rough. And they, going back to them skimming over the surface of the concept, they don't even really think through the specifics of how this would work. Like, you just bump into somebody and because all you have to do is bump arms and you lose that. Like, that doesn't make sense. So just some of those things that just you should have maybe thought, I don't know, 2 seconds about, and you would have drafted something a little bit better. And there's so much potential in it, but it just fell pretty hard.
I don't think, because it's Timberlake, right? If I remember right?
Yeah.
It's Timberlake.
Yeah.
I don't think Justin Timberlake was that great in that movie either. I don't think he was a good fit.
Not as the centerfold
right.
of the story.
Right. Olivia, was it Olivia Wilde? I think it was Olivia Wilde.
No, it was Amanda Seyfried.
Okay, well, whoever it was, they fit well. It was just Timberlake did not work for me. I saw this years ago. I only saw it once, so I don't have that one memorized. But good choice. Obscure one.
Yep.
Yeah, would have been really good if they would have, you know,
been a good
done
movie.
Their job.
My next one is going to be one of those where I get to make the rules. So it's the Star Wars prequels. All of them. Just all of them.
You are cheating today.
I don't think so. I didn't set this rule. And I said it to you guys earlier. It's not my fault you didn't read them. But I sent them. So you could have objected earlier. But no objection. So it stands. This was the origin story that fans thought they wanted. I mean, what made Anakin stray? What made Anakin Skywalker become Darth Vader? The love story of the ages between Padme and Anakin. How did the Emperor rise and Anakin fall? And we ended up with a movie with overwrought dialogue, the worst, worst romance in any science fiction film I can think of. Bad political moves. Everybody could see coming about a mile away. Ridiculous coincidences, a hero who randomly kills people and children with barely a reason, and whatever the hell Jar Jar was. I mean,
it's... Hey, don't come at Jar Jar, man.
I don't want to come. I never want to see Jar Jar again, okay? I want him in my blind spot.
Don't.
It just feels like, and so there are great moments in each one of these movies. Like, there are great scenes in each one of those movies. The Darth Maul fight is fantastic. The Yoda fight in Clones is fantastic. The battle on the lava pit is wonderful. There's so many cool moments. These aren't good movies. And the story missed so many opportunities, one after another. And that romance, which is the linchpin of everything, never once felt real. Not once.
It was so weird.
It was just bad. There had no chemistry. It made no sense. It was weird because the first movie, I mean, he's like 5 and she's looks like an adult. And then the next movie, they're like, what's up, girl? Hey, let's have some twins. You know, and it just went to Dawson's Creek in space way too fast. It just did not work for me in any stretch of the imagination. Do you guys agree, or are you, in hindsight, you're more forgiving of the prequels now?
God, I don't know, man. That's tough for me to say. Like, the sequels, the prequels are one thing. Like, I kind of take or leave, and sometimes I enjoy them, and sometimes I get frustrated. The sequels, on the other hand, the 7, 8, 9,
mm-hmm.
those I kind of have a problem with, just because they are like direct copies of 4, 5, and 6, and then at one point in the middle, somebody completely like tries to tell the story about how anyone can become a Jedi, but yet they still kind of screws up how that story is told.
What a wasted opportunity. That was what Skywalker should have been. The Rise of the Skywalker, whatever, the ninth movie, should have had that right. element. That was so powerful, or could have been so powerful. Sorry.
Absolutely. That's one of the things that lost me on Star Wars, as far as that's concerned.
You know, I still like the prequels. I know that I'm in the minority of people who will even watch them. I know I'm probably the only person who likes Jar Jar. I don't know. I just think he's cute. I'm not bothered by him. Don't come at me, bro. But I realize that these movies have serious problems.
Don't come
and
at
I'm
me,
okay
bro.
With that, because they're still fun. I feel like the prequels are the ones that can get your kids interested in it if they're not interested in it. And they see past all of the problems of a film. And it's almost like they're tailored for a child because they have those very, very memorable scenes that will grasp a child's attention. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're working for adults. And so for me, for whatever reason, I just kind of accepted the prequels and still like them. And I watch them. It's fine. I know that there's some problems. Anakin and Padme, I don't know. That is messed up. That is what we like to call now statutory rape.
Wow. Wow.
I mean, there's like a weird, you mentioned it, a weird age difference. He is like a literal child and she's like already past puberty. Like,
yeah, he's supposed to be 9 and she's supposed to be 14 at the time.
She looks 25. She just does. I can't.
I said supposed to be.
I can't help it. And the next movie, he's like 37 and she's still 25.
She's still 25. Yeah.
I don't quite understand how that math works, but yeah, it just didn't work for me. And Sean Gallagher on Twitter mentioned The Last Jedi, which you alluded to, that what do you say? No one you love is ever truly gone. Anyone can be a hero. Learn from failure. Really awesome themes. But good grief, the execution was terrible. And it has the longest. Here's my biggest problem with The Last Jedi. Everybody talks about that. The space battle. It's the most ridiculous thing. It lasts for the whole movie. Mm-hmm. They're basically waiting. Why would you wait if you're going to blow them out of the sky anyway? Why do you wait for an entire movie to make your move? It's just give them enough time to go on a casino heist. What? I love Rian Johnson. I think that is not a great Rian Johnson movie. I just don't. I'm with you.
They could have pulled so many other ways. This goes back to Kathleen Kennedy saying that there's no canon for them to pull from as far as where they can pull the stories from. And it frustrates me.
Yep. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. Remember, we will be back next week with our Black Widow and Bringing Characters Back from the Dead episode. Share your thoughts on this episode or anything else in our Facebook group, which is The Hollywood Outsider. It's a closed group. You got to look for. We're on Twitter at BuyPopcorn, and our site is TheHollywoodOutsider.com. Please rate and subscribe us on your preferred podcast app. That's going to do it. Thanks so much for listening. And remember, the next time that you go to the theater or sit comfortably on your couch and watch whatever streaming these days, because that's where a lot of content is, buy popcorn.